Good morning, everybody. I'd like to welcome everybody to the first plenary session, the first full day of Between the Worlds. I hope that everyone rested well last night, got plenty to eat, that you're taking care of yourself as we go forward through this event. Be mindful always to eat, and to rest as you need so. Drink plenty of water. This morning, we're very fortunate to have a panel of distinguished authors and thinkers and visionaries within the magical communities. In this time that we are passing through at this moment, many traditions hold that the world is not ending, i.e., blowing up, or anything of that nature. But change is coming. That there is a transition between the energies that have been a part of and been the signature of the previous age, the previous eon, the last 2,000 years, however it is you wish to define that. The age of Pisces. There's a variety of names and labels that are given to that which is the culture, the society, the energy that were a part of and informed and set the background to our experiences, our organizations, the cultures, the concepts, the worldview that we have been a part of. And that is now going through a transition. And it matters not whether you believe in any specific label, any specific ideal about what was before and what will be. One looks at the world and sees that things are changing. We as magical people are a part of that. We are a part of that culture. We are sensitive to the shifting and changing and transforming energies. So today we're going to be talking about the turning of the age, what to keep, what to throw away, and how to decide. And we have with us a distinguished panel, Ivo Dominguez Jr., who is an elder and the founder of the Assembly of the Sacred Wheel, T. Thorne Coyle, author, ritualist, and the founder of the Solar Cross, Eptha, who is the director of studies and the visionary and primary guide to Lighthaven, North Carolina. Katrina Messenger, who is the head of the Reflections Mystery School. And Samuel Webster, author, instructor, teacher. And you'll have to help me, Sam, because the name of your publishing house just went right out of my head.
Concrescent
Publishing. So before we get started, I would ask each one of our panelists to make a brief statement about what they perceive, what they think it is that we are facing as we go through this transition between what was before and what is now and what will be, and what part our communities will play in that transition.
How many hours each do we have?
How fast can you talk?
That's right. Yeah, you have 3 minutes for an opening statement. I have a bell. So whomever would like to start, is more than welcome to do so, or I will call on you.
Can we nominate?
Sam, would you start, please?
Yeah, they all step backwards.
If you'll, Sam.
Mike, hello.
Good morning.
All right, big picture, then little picture. Big picture looks like this. As far as I can see, for this species, the humans, the dominant sentient species on this planet, the technological species on it, we are in the later stages of our adolescence and are right now in the middle of our adulthood crises. The portion of me that thinks it's lived on other places says that this is normal to a species. And like all other adulthood rituals, there are only two outcomes. There's either an adult or a corpse. Okay, because in real societies that have adulthood rituals, you cannot have adult children. So that's the outcome. And they're tested pretty severely, men or women. It does not matter. The only thing that you can have as an outcome is an adult. And right now, we still soil our nest. You know, we don't actually behave like adults. We eat more than we can. We eat more than we can actually produce. We consume everything in sight. That's not adult behavior, right? All of us who have achieved some degree of adulthood on a personal level know that we need to stay within our due bounds. So this is the crisis facing our species. And I'm fairly convinced from everything I see that it's our generation that gets to make the decision. And it's our age group, roughly, in here that's going to be doing that. And then we will hand to the next generation or so either a world that will be sustainable or not. And they will get to bear the consequences of this. We've already raised the temperature a degree, maybe a little more. If we get to 6, we're not going to be here. Okay, maybe we might have a few people left over, but the planet will just have a fever, will die, and it will go on. Ahem.
That's wolves howling at the door.
And yes, they are.
Ragnarok.
So, where do we fit in? In Western society, since the Protestant Reformation, abandoned ritual. The tool for transmitting values down the generations, and we can see at least 30, maybe 40,000 years of this that's been cut off from the culture that's driving the change. I think that's a problem. Except for us. We are the only living ritual tradition left in the Western culture. I mean, the Catholics do their ritual, but they're dead. They don't change, they don't transmute. We design new rituals every weekend. This is what in ritual studies was thought to be impossible, except in the last 10, 15 years they've finally gotten over themselves. What I believe is that we bear the standard for transformation. We know how to initiate. We know how to transform both ourselves and others. And therefore, this is our duty. When nobody else has the capacity to do a thing, then it falls to you to do it, especially if you know that it needs to be done. And this is the essence of what I think we bring to bear. We bring inner change, outer change, and a way of looking at the world that is, to use a hackneyed phrase, more holistic, more spiritual. We don't necessarily see that science is separated from religion. We don't see that what we eat is different from medicine. You know, these are all parts of the whole life that we create. So I'm going to stop there because there are so many more to be had, but that's the frame I'm coming from.
Keep it simple. Okay, what he said. I've been saying for a very long time that I was going to wear one of those placards that said, "The end is near, rejoice." Because quite frankly, I would like to see the end of the world as we know it. The opposite view is we will reach our end and the planet will rejoice. But in reality, it's not so simple. I like the comparison to achieving adulthood when we're still engaging in such adolescent, pre-adolescent behavior. One of the issues that is critical for us going forward is that we must stop believing that the problem is out there. The problem is other people. And because if you understand how magic works, that it must be a change within that reverberates outward. And if we can't see the change that's necessary within us, the change in the world cannot come from us. It's really important to include yourself, include ourselves, all of us, within that change. One of the things that has to break down, that has to move, that has to break up to make space for what is needed in the new world is our tendency to create stone out of sand. Things that can be mobile and flexible and changeable and quite uncomfortable, we like to freeze and hold it tight because we are uncomfortable with change. How are we going to be the source of change if we are unwilling to change ourselves? I was thinking recently, looking at some of the things that came from the Occupy movement, which is just phenomenal, and that you can see the beginnings of it going all the way back to the Civil War and before. You can see some of it in the French Revolution, for example. That this need to be able to communicate at the level of person to person, to recognize the inalienable right of people to choose where they live, where they love, how they accomplish, what they want to do in the world, what democracy was supposed to be the promise of, how to make decisions where all of us have skin in the game. Because it's not fair if you don't have skin in the game. And so, there are ways in which we must open our minds, open our hearts, open our souls to movement, to flexibility. Now, I'm not asking for flexibility and movement that says there's no accountability or there's no compassion, but we must be willing to question those things that we hold the most in our hearts, to question our beliefs, to test them, to validate them in the world. Is this true? Has it ever been true? One of the things that is incredibly important is for us to understand how much our culture separates and alienates. How much our culture has inherent within it the need to have strong fences because we don't know how to live together. So many of us have dreams of communal living and we don't even grasp why we have fences in the first place or walls. There's a thing called containment. There's things called boundaries. And we must learn not only what they really mean, we must learn what they mean within our lives and within ourselves. And that when you cross a boundary, you must cross it with intention, with purpose. I remember explaining to someone who had crossed a boundary, I'm not going to tell you what it is, and they were upset that someone said, "You shouldn't do that." And I said, "Well, if you knew it was a boundary and you were planning to cross, what was your expectation upon crossing it?" And I talked about things like the civil rights movement and how we people were trained how to go to jail. If you're going to cross a boundary, you better be prepared for the consequences of that crossing. If you plan to grow, you better have a plan to nurture. And if you have a plan to break something down, you better have a plan to grow something. And so there's a way in which we have to change our internal processes, have to question those things that we hold very true in our hearts, some of which we're not aware of, before we can actually be the sources of change in the world. So that's at the personal level. At the mythic level, our myths are going to shatter. The ones that are closest to our hearts, things like that we don't think about as Americans, for example, like Paul Bunyan, right? The great individual, as opposed to the Johnny Appleseed, as the person who travels and instigates growth and moves on. We need to really question the mythic, not only within the sense of our American culture, but also our world culture. We are creating right now the new myths. And we are the least able to see them. But some of us, someone has to have some consciousness that these new myths have to be based on shared values. It has to be the shared dreams. And so, if anything, I would hope we would understand is our role in this process is not going to be easy. As I say in my school, you know, we can focus on safety, but it will still be uncomfortable. And that is the work of us changing from this age to the new age. We're already in that process. We just need to catch up in ourselves.
Well, Katrina, you got me on uncomfortable. That's one of our theme songs at Lighthaven. You know, because I guess where I would like to dovetail off of where you went, which is our own sense of our inner landscape, you know, our experience of ourselves, because we really are defined and have been defined by our culture, by our experiences. And yet everybody is here because, frankly, you've sort of pushed past at least some of that. Because I suspect the majority of the people in this room were raised or at least exposed to a more traditional way of approaching your religion, your spirituality, your sense of identity. And yet everyone here has challenged that in some way, form, or fashion, because otherwise we wouldn't be here. Our sense of self isn't a static. It is a constantly living, growing, moving, organic process. And part of our opportunity is to grow. But to, as Katrina said, as Sam said, to grow consciously. And part of what I would challenge is our sense of what it means to be an individual. Because I really think that in our communities, and certainly in our culture, that really grabs us. Because we are very, part of our story is our uniqueness. And we're attached to our uniqueness. And we are attached to how we, you know, I mean, I put on my bling today, you know, because I'm going to, hey, you know, because, you know, I want to be an individual. I want to stand out. I want to be, if nothing else, on this panel looking good, you know. Yeah. Going for it. And yes, perhaps, though, I can at least acknowledge it honestly within myself. And it's not that desire for your own sense of self is quote-unquote wrong. But it is also something that then means, what about other sense of self? And when we all put those senses of self together, how does that move in consciousness to the next level? When Katrina was talking about, you know, our mythic landscape, our internal sense of how the world is, and where the world is going. See, part of I see is the challenge is we have no idea. You know, I appreciate, you know, Michael's wonderful stance of we are visionaries, but I will acknowledge, at least for myself, that my vision is defined through the perceptions of my glasses that are framed by my day-to-day experiences. And yes, that's part of why we do meditation, is to transcend that identification with our day-to-day experiences, but we are still in relationship with it. So part of it, I think, for me, is that I can say, okay, I recognize that there is this part of me that is dry and brittle and attached to what is, to how I see what is supposed to be, even what I think growth is supposed to be, and be open to the possibility that it may be something that is appropriate to step beyond, not just one moment, but over and over and over again. And I absolutely appreciate what Sam was saying about the power of our rituals, because, you know, the Indo-European definition of ritual is putting things together. Well, you know, one of the mythos that I'm attached to is the remembering of Osiris. And what I see is that we are remembering. But the difference is that recognizing Osiris as a creator god, as a creator force. So it isn't that we get put back together and we stay. It is that we get put back together over and over and over again. And being willing to go through the dismemberment over and over and over again, which isn't a comfortable place to be. As we said, I'm uncomfortable. And then when we put those parts back together in that holistic way, what do those parts mean? If we are indeed believing what we say we believe, which is it is all interconnected, what is this part of the whole in relationship to the other parts of the whole? These are big, big concepts. And yet we're living it. It isn't just something out here, or we can try to keep it out here, but the truth is that our opportunity and our call in our spiritual communities is on that day-to-day, moment-to-moment base, is to remember.
Mic check. One of my favorite signs from Occupy is the beginning is near. I want us all to take just a moment to sense your body and sense your energy field. Keep your eyes open, people. Sense your energy field, and then sense the person next to you, and the person beyond that, and the person behind you, and the person in front of you. And sense the body we form together in this room. Sense that organism. And sense how you are not diminished by being this organism. Listening to this and being aware of this is part of what teaches me something else is possible. These kingdoms of separation we have created for and with ourselves are not necessary anymore. It doesn't mean the cell walls have burst. It means the cells are learning to work together. So we are still cells with our boundaries, and yet we're working as a whole. At least I think that is what is possible. And my lesson right now is listening and sensing. I think perhaps we are entering as a whole, and I know this is true of myself individually in this time, I think we can become more interested in what is possible for us to learn rather than what is possible for us to teach? And what are we trying to learn together as we move in this time? That's really interesting to me. And that requires flexibility that's been mentioned. And that requires openness to ritual that's been mentioned, right? So, yes, how are we informed in that Platonic sense? How are we informed by the old rituals? And how are we then transformed towards the new rituals, towards the innovation? And I feel that's where we are right now, is in this conversation between form, no form, between this deep teaching and what is yet to come that we don't even comprehend. How do we put ourselves in the position where we can actually make the paradigm shift? Because, as we know, in paradigm shift in science, it is said it takes root when the old generation has died, as Sam was talking about, right? The corpse or the adult. And as magic workers, I think we have a great opportunity to navigate that change. Part of it is, those of us who are diligent in our practice and in our study, in the pathways of self-examination, in communication with our guides, our allies, our gods, our goddesses, we have a chance to teach our egos a different story. And therefore, our egos have a chance to learn something new, rather than continuously saying, no, this form is me. This form is me. We can say, actually, I don't know. Here's a foundation, here's a basis that I can grow from, but I can be curious about this. I want to be curious about this. And to me, curiosity is going to help us through any transition, large or small. So can I be curious myself about my life, about my relationships, about my beloveds, about my friends, about my work, my practice? And can we be curious with each other? What can we create? Or what can we learn? What is coming? I don't know. Did you catch that scent? Did you hear that tone? Let's follow that for a little bit. Let's see. And part of what helps me with this practice is peership. Having strong peers to experiment with, to bounce ideas off of, to argue with, is really, really helpful to my curiosity and my flexibility, right? It helps me stretch, it helps me grow, it helps me remember I don't know everything, and boy, my ego really thinks it knows everything. Just ask any of my friends. So let's just take in a breath of curiosity for a moment. We can learn how to learn something new.
So I'll say something that magical folks have in addition to the power of ritual and initiation and all the good things that I've agreed with so far, which is a really good thing. Otherwise, there'll be arm wrestling, and I might lose. But we also are aware of the fact that time is not a simple thing, and change is not a simple thing. And the only way we make a transition through great periods of change is by becoming aware of the fact that there is the moment that is now, and there is a broader now that includes a bit of the past and a bit of the future. and things that span generations, and some tides and trends that can only be seen over centuries. I know without looking too hard in this room that I see many faces of people that are lovers of history, or of archaeology, or of geology, and as such have developed a broader sense of what time is. This is why I'm asking you to be patient. I'm going to repeat this a lot. I'm going to say it until I believe that it has sunk into myself as well as everyone else. If you are in this room today, your entire life work is about the change of the ages, period. I'll use an example I've given before. If tomorrow were the spring equinox, would you put away all your cold weather clothing? No, because spring doesn't appear in one day. It takes weeks until finally we're there. With something as slow and as subtle and as large as the turning of the ages, and we can talk about why I think that's actually happening and perhaps later in this talk, then that means that what changes takes place over the course of decades. Anybody here, I know Diatima's in back, and she'll nod vigorously on this one. So 360 degrees in a circle, yes? So if we divide the heavens into 360 degrees, and we click 1 degree marker, we've changed 1 degree of motion in the precession of the ages, that's 72 years. So even the youngest person in this room, unless you're being planned on being downloaded into a mainframe and, you know, becoming immortal in some kind of bizarre. By the way, this is an example of the kind of escapism that
the singularity is nigh.
Well, if that meant... It has been for centuries. And if that means dropping people into a black hole, maybe that's okay. But the point is that I have been observing trends for many decades now and correlating them to astrology. And if we get to talk about that a little bit, I'd like to do that because, no, none of us can say this is what will work or this is what will be or this will have to be done this way. Have you ever built a house? Are there ever adjustments to the blueprints? Have you ever tried to tile your bathroom or your kitchen? Are there ever adjustments? My point is, even if you had perfect crystal guidance and vision of this is the way things are to be, once you try to manifest and implement them, they require adjustment. But what we can learn from the sacred science of astrology and other things is there are things that are favored and things that are not. If there were a drum beating softly in the background in this room, sooner or later, most people in the room that can hear well would find that they were tapping their finger or some part of their body was responding to that rhythm. Here's the other part about being a magical person. You are making an effort to remain awake. Now, this is not such an easy thing. And indeed, I would say that for most of us, including myself, and I'd probably get agreement for most of the panel, it is hard to remain awake and present. We fade out all the time. The problem is that when the world is changing, people respond, but they don't respond in an awake and aware way. It is a response to that rhythm of the energy has shifted. The rhythm of the world has shifted, and the world begins to turn towards that rhythm, but not necessarily with the awareness of how that has come about. So when people speak of things like Pisces and Aquarius, etc., and you don't have to be an astrologer to understand, those represent energy signatures, patterns of information, or a descriptive language for the universe. And by looking at those things, we can get a guess of which things are going to be emphasized, perhaps overemphasized, and which things are going to be diminished with the change. It does not tell you how things will play, but it does tell you what the environment, what the field of forces and forms is going to be like that you have to be aware of. And if you can navigate that with awareness, with clarity of being present, then you can make a good choice. Good choice, by the way, may be a mistake. But it will be the right bad choice. We only find out, when we function out of our core and our awareness of the fact that we are agents of change for the rest of your life and you are one of the midwives of the change, then the errors you make will be instructive and actually be useful information to pass on to the next ones, as opposed to the errors that we make because we are asleep at the wheel. And they are really qualitatively very different, good errors and bad errors. So what I will say is that everything that my friends and beloveds on the panel have said so far requires you to be awake, because the trend of the age of Aquarius does not like us to play nice with each other. Aquarius is the sign of ideology. The shadow of the age is Leo. Now, there is good and bad in each of those things. And if you don't believe the ages or astrology, let me give you an example and keep tabs on time for me.
Okay.
How about this? Who knows what Billboard magazine is? Okay. How many people in this room are above 40? Figured as much. How about this? Once upon a time, Billboard magazine had how many charts for the popular music? One. And there can be only one. What has occurred over the last several decades is, how many genres and subgenres and charts are we keeping? Pisces is about unity and oneness. Aquarius is about division and splitting into the small and to the many. When I was in high school riding my dinosaur, I could, without a
with
moment's
Jesus.
Thought, tell you, yeah, with Jesus. Absolutely, absolutely. We were buds. We were aware intimately of, this is what everyone thinks is the best and most popular song. If you did a poll, most people are unaware of the vast range of what constitutes this is my music, or this is my style, or this is my fashion, this is my politics, this is my belief structure, this is the language I use to describe my sexuality. There has been an explosion of diversification of many and 1,001 subcultures. That is Aquarius. Aquarius is individuation. So, for us to go from being no offense to Pisces, going from the all and one and trying to standardize to all being different and still working as an organism, that is only possible with awareness. Otherwise, we head to 2,000 years that will make the age of Pisces look like a cakewalk. Clean and simple. Clean and simple. And I could suggest to you that if you look through history, you'll find again and again the pattern is repeating. We are becoming more diverse, therefore the necessity for awareness becomes higher. And I'll pause with that.
Thank you, everybody. There's a lot to think about in what these five panelists have said. There's a lot of various information, ideas, and concepts. And in fact, it has actually thrown out all the questions I had. So.
Well done. Excellent.
It is the burden of the moderator. So, what's interesting, though, there's a couple of themes there that I would like to get some opinions on. One of them is that there is, in the diversity, it appears, that there's not just the diversity that is increasing, you know, between communities, a variety of organizations and different communities and how they define themselves, and then how they define, unfortunately, part of the adolescent stage, I believe, how they define what they're not. They spend enormous amounts of time telling you what they're not without thinking about what they are. Then you have this internal struggle that's going on about that very same question. What am I? Versus spending an enormous amount of time about thinking what I'm not. And if we accept this idea that there is increased diversification, how do we go about the process of beginning to answer some of those questions? How do we step away from defining ourselves and our communities during these transitions by what we're not? How do we get away from that adolescent behavior? That's the whole, you know, mommy told me to do this and I'm not doing it. It's the best thing for me and I should do it, but because I'm being told this, I'm not that and I'm not doing it. How do we, both individually and then as broader communities, begin to step away from that and embrace what it is that we actually are? Does that sound like an okay question? Mm-hmm. Okay. Have at it.
Start on this
one. Oh, this is a free form thing. We're past this point. You know, jump in there. Just no chair throwing.
I can start. One thing I've been working with a lot lately, with myself and my clients and students, is I ask, what's your large arc? Meaning, what's the large intention, the large desire, the large wish? And how do the smaller and smaller arcs, so here's my long-term arc that, of course, is changeable, it's mutable, because as I move, everything changes, right? How am I mapping the arc of the coming 5 years, the arc of the coming year, the arc of the month, the arc of the week, the arc of the day, the arc of this moment? How are they resonating back and forth, right? That gives me a gauge. So I can then say, oh, in the arc of this moment, I was out of phase with my large arc. What kind of choices am I making on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis? Am I telling all my soul parts that my large arc is really just a fantasy and I never have to put effort towards it? Because that's what a lot of us do, right? When there's not resonance back and forth, the smallest arc informs the largest arc and the largest arc informs the smallest arc. So we can do that as individuals and we can do that as groups. I think we're coming into a time where it would be really helpful to all of us to say, what's the large arc of our school, our tradition, our coven, our lodge? And then how are our practices and rituals and the ways in which we interact with each other reflecting or not reflecting that? I think we're all coming to a place where it would be really helpful to us in our communities to have those conversations and start making those kind of decisions.
No, you go. No, good. I'm doing the nice thing. I can only hold on to the thought for just a moment. Just let me go with it. What I'd like to kind of go back to is the issue of defining ourselves by what we're not. And I can speak for myself. That's where I go because it's defined. You know, it's a comfortable place to go because the whole aspect of what I am is not as easily defined, particularly in what I have experienced myself in the last decade or so, and certainly in the last year. So it's an easier, comfortable place to be, to say I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm not this, because it's familiar, it's known, it seems to be known at least. But part of where I would even go back to behind the what I'm not is why do I need to be able to define what I'm not? What is that feeding in me? And I think part of what it feeds in me is that it gives me a sense of some sort of ground that I'm standing on. And since I don't
know exactly how necessarily to define what I am, then at least I know what I'm not, and I'm not feeling like I'm falling down the elevator shaft. And part of what I've been challenging myself, and we've been working with at Lighthaven, is being comfortable falling down the elevator shaft. And that's, and I say down because I don't know about y'all guys, I hadn't exactly been feeling like I've been going up. It's been feel like a downward shot. And I appreciate the desire to be able to have an identification with what I am, but I also think that part of the challenge with that is to be able to, again, leave the space for that to grow in form. Going back to the experience we have had at Lighthaven, is in the last 2 to 5 years, we've experienced ourselves and our tradition as not on the step that we have been, but not quite on the step we're moving to, and in midair. I'm wondering if anyone else, please tell me you can relate to this. Yeah, okay. Because it really is, and it takes everything I have to not define. It takes everything I have because it is safer for me to define it, even if it was in the wrong way. Because it is defined. And granted, I completely concur with Evo's statement that, you know, if we are working consciously, even our mistakes are those points that we can grow from and inform the next choice. But what I encourage us to do is to be open to the new areas of mind that we are stepping over the threshold and being willing to be in midair. That doesn't mean, as Katrina said earlier, we're not responsible. It doesn't, in fact, on the contrary, it means we have to listen that much more. It means that we have to be willing to be that much more responsible and accountable. It's a dangerous place to be. And yes, you know, as I appreciate what Evo said. The Saturnian in me is, you know, I appreciate Mr. Doom and Gloom. You know, the next yes, I know. I'm a Saturnian, you know. It's like, because the next 2,000 years, I'm going to look that good. If we don't.
Can I just clarify? I just want to clarify what I said earlier. That large arc is not a definition. It's an intention.
You know, I think it's pronounced IRMI, I-R-M-I, the way of unknowing, of being able to move into the unknowing. And that's a very uncomfortable position, and I completely agree. And as far as making the correct mistakes, always eat the pomegranate seeds. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying. Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why there are mistakes that are necessary. Mm-hmm. So, one of the things about how do we move in this period of change from the one to the many, without losing our connections to the whole, I'd like to take people back. You know, the ages change over time, as Evo said, but Evo, his degree of change is very narrow, while mine is very wide. I think it's like 400 years. And so when I look back, that's why I said the French Revolution is very, very instrumental for our understanding of how these things happen. I remember in the 70s drawing lines of demarcation, because we needed to make sure that people knew how we were different from that other group who had almost the same name, mm-hmm. wore similar clothes, and had similar banners. Mm-hmm. We were the Bolshevik, you know, Revolutionary Workers League, not the Revolutionary Workers League Trotskyites. Yeah. So we were drawing lines of demarcation, and it was in an effort to define who we were. It was to find a place to stand. Because, you know, when they tell you that, you know, what to do during an earthquake, they don't tell you to run around. They say find some place to stand. And so it is our natural inclination to try to define a place. But you have to understand where you're trying to stand on is moving as well. So you will not be successful, and you will find a spot, but you will not be comfortable nor feel safe in this new place that you're standing. So just get over it. And I think part, yeah, truly. Get over it, because truly that is the part that makes us long for things that are that we can hold on to. Mm-hmm. That what makes us long to hold on to those old stories, which, quite frankly, many of them were never true. Mm-hmm. And that's an important thing to understand. This morning, Angela, where's Angela? Yeah, Angela was teasing me because she brought me this little headband with a skull on it and glitter and feathers. It's really cute. And she was laughing about, yeah, I should have brought it so I could have wear it to the gala. And I said, well, Angela, I'm wearing all black. If I put that on my head, people are going to assume that I'm a voodoo queen. And she sort of laughed, and I sort of laughed. And then I said, no, really? Think about this. I'm black. Yeah. Never noticed. So if I put a skull on my head, what is the natural?
Goth.
And that has never been true.
I
Yeah, right. Do you get what I'm saying? That has never been true. Yeah, it's part of the stories in our head, and those stories have never been true. I need you to get that. This is part of what we're up against. We have things in our minds that are playing out that covers our lenses of our eyes. They are stories we implant on the world around us, and then we don't have to see the world. Part of that is our natural human inclination to make pattern recognition, so you don't have to go through, after 30 minutes, yes, it's a tree. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So that pattern recognition system that we have is part of how we survive, because if we're having to run from, you know, the dinosaurs was ridden by Jesus through the ancient forest, we don't have to go, tree, what is that? That's another tree, you know. That's what pattern recognition does. But pattern recognition doesn't stop at survival mode in reality. It jumps to survival mode in our mental images. Right. So those who are different are dangerous. And we attach stories to that. Parts. I remember someone telling me, you live in D.C.? How is that possible? I said, you know, there are houses there. There are stories we have never been true. And we're talking about, you know, looking at things in the world and being, you know, quite frankly, what I say in my school, beacons of hope for the world. And we're walking around with these stories across our eyes. And so one of the ways in which we can look at ourselves and these organizations and these communities and these movements is it's not just waking up. It's waking up and having a practice that removes that crap from your eyes. Because, you know, you can't make good decisions about what to do in the world if you're not actually looking at it. You know? I mean, have you ever tried to get something to work and something to work and something to work and then realized you had the wrong tool? It might have something to do with it. And so that's an important part of that, is to question the very stories that you see on the world that you believe are there and question them out loud with each other. And this calls for not just honesty, but it calls for tolerance. Because this is one of the things I've noticed, that we are not very tolerant of people trying to learn how to be better human beings. And so we have to actually find ways to be tolerant and show compassion, not only for them, but for ourselves. Because it's a very difficult process. So yeah, one of the ways we do that is waking up and constantly cleansing that lens.
Thorne or Sam, did you have anything to add to that?
Identity politics, scary thing, but necessary, I think, at a certain level. Back in the 70s and 80s, we were really one community. I mean, there was kind of a split between the magicians and the witches, but a lot of us ran both ways, so that kind of got washed out a lot. And there were times we actually did rituals to bring both communities together. There were basically two. You know, and the witches were there, the pagans were kind of the vague development of that, and sort of the big tent. And right now, we're going through very much a phase of individuation, all these different kinds of groups developing. We have the various Reconstructionist trads all developing, and to a certain extent, this is good. It's kind of like when a homogeneous single-cell organism starts breaking up into differentiated organism, and then they can articulate themselves better. I mean, you know, the amoebas did not conquer the planet. We did. For better or for worse. But identity is a funny thing. We get really attached to it. And one of the great traditions on dealing with this problem is the Buddhist. Now, I'm not a Buddhist, but I've learned a lot from them. And I'll be talking about more of that later. But one of their great lessons is there ain't no self. This thing we think of as a self is a projection, it's a grasping, it's a delusion, really. And identity politics is about reifying a sense of self. We define ourselves in a particular way, and therefore we have to say, no, that's not me, though that's not me, though that's not me. And actually, all too often, it actually is us, but we don't want to accept that, and so yeah, it's more comfortable. Just try contemplating for a moment that there is no self here, that there is only this collection of stuff, a whirlwind that has gathered up a batch of dust, of matter and of idea, that temporarily looks like an entity. I bet that's uncomfortable. It can get really uncomfortable. It can be a sense of falling. Falling down a shaft, falling into the stars, like laying on your back in a field in the summertime. It requires a giving up of identity. But sometimes that requires creating an identity in the first place to give it up. So what we're doing is a healthy, natural process as long as we don't get stuck. And where we learn to cross those boundaries again once we've established them. And instead of saying, I am I, or by self-abuse, but by the living act, to quote Austin Osman Spare, we keep taking on new identities and transform ourselves each time, determining, oh yes, no, that wasn't me. And maybe there is no me, but just this continuous wavefront, this articulation of the whole in this particular part being driven by some inchoate and never really knowable desire, some ineffable will that is striving. And it's in that irritation, in that annoyance, in that discomfort that I know I strive. My greatest creativity has come out of me being annoyed at something. And the most enduring and useful projects have all come because I was just pissed off at what people were calling me. And by accident, I made good things. It wasn't what I was trying to do.
All I knew is that I was irritated, and I had to talk about it. And then something grew up. Ah. But if I was identified as any of those things that I was before that moment, then I might not have noticed the tree growing under my feet and not stop to water it and grow something good. I'm not any of the things that I name myself. Those are masks or shrouds or ornaments that I wear temporarily. And tomorrow I may be shedding them all and becoming something else. Sometimes reality requires that of me. Death comes. I've seen it up close in really unpleasant ways. To watch all of my dreams destroyed just because, hi, sorry, you have cancer and you're dying. Goodbye. So all those identities that I attached to, I had to let go of. And I keep attaching, and I keep having to let go. I think that's a good practice. But I equally think it's important to build, to invoke, to create, to establish, ready to tear it apart again. There's more, but that's enough for now.
I'm going to ask you to focus on what you can do that so many other people can't. Let me tell you why. I've been involved in a lot of movements and a lot of politics over the years, and now I'm going to rail against it. As you may know, I did a lot of work involved in changing the laws in the state relative to gay lesbian issues, gender issues, HIV and AIDS, etc., and I would do it again in a heartbeat. However, all of us have different arenas of our lives, and we have only so many hours in the day, and only so much energy, and so much time. Again and again, when I was involved heavily in those movements, I saw people that I wanted desperately to remain in the fight, who went off to do animal rights, environmentalism, and a dozen other things that I completely agreed with. But then I said to myself, and we have now lost somebody who is a fabulous ritualist or a great dancer or a great artist whose energy is no longer being poured into creating the culture of the magical community. Here's the thing. You can't be everything. This is a word from Saturn. I am the rolling Saturn return, I guess, in some people's lives, and I think I will remain that. So what I'm going to say is that find what you do well, and then also ask yourself to think outside yourself, and here's where we may part company. I don't care if it's the thing that you like best. I don't care if it's the thing you like best. Which you is answering that question? Because I can think of a dozen things that I could be doing with my life that might feed other needs or other desires, and the world would not benefit in the same way. Whatever your brightest talents are, whatever your capacities are, ask yourself, am I fleeing from those or am I embracing them? Because when there is great change in the world, I think there's a great need for spirituality and magic as we define it, and ritual as we define it, and there are relatively few numbers of people that know what that is, and they need to survive and spread it and develop it and evolve it. Jim and I have been together 34 years, and it's also no surprise to many of you that we also have an open-ended, multifaceted, sometimes complicated poly kind of relationship. And at the same time, we were there at the very beginning of AIDS, HIV. We were actually the ones that approached the Blood Bank of Delaware and said, you have to start testing blood, and here's how, long before the CDC. Anyway, we also warned them it was coming. Do you know one of our early discussions was, no matter what happens in this epidemic, we must carry the torch of being sex positive, because it had the possibility of it becoming a culture where that which is one of the joys and the beauty of passion in life would be considered something terrible and dangerous. In the same way, there is 1,001 ways that you can help the world, but if too many of us invest our energy in those fights rather than in the creation of something that nurtures and feeds and provides experiences for transformation, then we will be a dying breed. So I'm not saying don't do some of the things you need to do, but if we are to work as magical folks, as creators of emerging religions, fill in the blank for what your language prefers, then we must remember that if we don't do it and we don't develop it, then we are impoverishing the world in a way that is significant. Indeed, can everything return to the world that has vanished? Yes. How many decades do you want to lose? And if you are of the belief, as I am, that we are in an important time period, we cannot afford to wait several decades for things like trance practice, dance ritual, initiation to return and resolve itself into the world again. Anything returns. Everything returns. But right now is the wrong time to leave it to chance. I'll just stop at that.
Michael, can I address one thing around that? The other piece that I would add in is that I think we have to get through our attachment, or at least many of us do, at we want to see the results.
Yes.
We want to see the results, and we want to see the outcome. Yeah, exactly. You know, and you know, it's the classic story of how many thousands of years did it take to build a cathedral, to build Stonehenge, to build Angkor Wat. It goes on and on. But we are sometimes, what I perceive that happens to us in spiritual communities is we start our community, it's going strong, things are happening, and then it seems like there's a plateau that's reached, or things aren't happening, or it doesn't feel as good, or it's a lot of more work, or I'm working and working and working and nothing seems to be happening. And we want to see the results of it now, and we want to see the results, frankly, in our lifetime. And I perceive that if I'm doing my job, then I'm not going to see the end game in my lifetime. And if I have done my, if I'm not doing my job, then I'm going to see an end game, but it's because I didn't stick it out.
One of the things that came out of the excellent comments y'all made, it appears, and it goes back to something that I experienced not too long ago, when in a different circumstance and things that I am involved in, someone was complaining that it seemed like there's all these other groups arising that are trying to do exactly the same thing that we're doing, and that person was quite angry about it. And I reminded that person that we, in this transitional time, we are having a speciation event where you have an explosion of species, of organizations, of groups, of communities, of little clusters and cadres of people. And one of the problems and one of the powers of a speciation event is that the strong survive and the rest go extinct. Is there something that we should be mindful of? Something that we should be doing? How can we, or should we, be involved when extinction of a particular species is inevitable? And it may be that everyone on the panel says, it'll be whatever it is. But it goes back to something I think that Ivo had said, and you know, about good mistakes and bad mistakes. And sometimes the bad mistakes is pouring tons of time and energy and effort into something that is inevitably going to fail. How do we make those choices? What do we look for? Is there anything that we can do?
One of the things that some of you know my history, with the different political movements over the, you know, latest 40 sort of, you know, years. Mm-hmm. and one of the groups I was with, our job was what we did, we called building mass organizations. And then organizing groups either within neighborhoods or on workplaces. And one of the questions we used to ask is, what is it when this ends, because we know everything will end, what will there be as a result of this work? And so, for example, if we went in to organize in the neighborhood, say something simple, like to get a traffic light or a stop sign, or to hold accountable a police department, or to make a playground. We always chose those things that when we finished, what would be left are people who knew that they could change things. It didn't even matter if we got the playground, mm-hmm. or the stop sign or the traffic light. And that's the part that I think is sort of missing sometimes in these discussions, is what do you want to be there when it ends? We think everything lives forever, which is amazing, being that we're all mortal and we live in the realm of time. But we forget that it is possible to build things. If we look through some of our indigenous societies, it is possible to build things and their effect to last longer than the things that were built. And that's something that is difficult to imagine until you realize there are most things that have been built in this world, the effect lasted longer than the thing. That's why we look at things like the pyramids and Angkor Wat. Mm-hmm. It's because those are some of the few things that have survived. And so sometimes it is necessary to nurture that infant that you know will die. Because it's not about the infant, it's about those who will mourn the loss, knowing that the work that was necessary was done. And that is easier to say than when we talk about an organization, a movement, a building, right? When to let it go, or when to put in energy to infuse a certain type of understanding into a community, into a group, into a moment that they will take from it. And so sometimes, and this, I'm not saying any of this is easy. Actually, I've said everything I've suggested has been very, very hard. Speaking of Saturn energy. What is it? My Saturn is in Scorpio, so. So I think, yeah, we have to make choices about our time. That's something that we all have to face. You know, we can find eternity in the now, but there is only a limited amount of energy that we can pour into the things that we focus on, so we must choose wisely. But some of us, we need to learn how to think at a different level. And that's where I always talk about the mythic level. Like, what is the overall purpose of this, and how does it figure in the mythos of this community? What will they learn? What will they take from this? And I miss that from that old movement I was in, something to think about. But it is still something we should consider when we consider where our energy goes. Because if you're working towards something so that it will always be, as opposed to working for something that you know will be here only for a time, you sort of pour your energy in a different way. And that's something to consider. So I just wanted to support that in that way.
I want to take Michael's question and go back to some of the things Ivo spoke to, as well as some of what Katrina just brought. My first thought and impulse is to say, we need to feel the pain and not get trapped in it. We're not just talking about buildings and communities and movements. Michael said species, right? There are wars going on all over the world right now. That's part of this process. There are animals dying who will be no more. That is part of this process. We need to feel the pain and not get caught in it. That is a very difficult practice and a really necessary practice for our souls to remain compassionate and open and fiercely connected and also still say, here is what I can and cannot do. I agree with Ivo that there is work for each of us to do. That's what my new book is about. And I know that my work, I used to work full-time in a soup kitchen. That was not my full-time work of my soul. I go there once a week now, it's necessary. I need to feel the pain and work for justice for young black men in my communities because they are being killed at an alarming rate, right? That gives me grief to stand with their parents when their child has just been killed by the police unnecessarily because they were young black men. I have to do that work and feel that pain, and that is not my larger work. I cannot devote all of my energy to that. However, it makes up my personal emotional and spiritual ecosystem and the ecosystem of my community, and my work is also larger than that simultaneously. As soon as I get trapped in that work, I'm no longer resonating with my large arc, right? So how do we deal with this? We don't just say, no, that's not my work, I'm not going to pay attention. We say, what makes me feel more whole, including the art, the joy, the sex, the food, the beauty, including the deep pain, the injustice, the toxic waste dump cleanup? And then what is my work in the world? And I swim in all of that. I swim in all of that.
We're getting on the doom and gloom train here. I
mentioned sex.
That doesn't necessarily negate my argument.
Sex, death, sex, death.
Okay, so I do want to go a different way, if only just to brighten up the energy a little bit. I think there are specific things we can do. In this speciation thing, the thing that I'm advocating for us all to do is to rebuild the cult of the gods. Mm-hmm. All of them that we know. For every person who has a direct connection with a or many deities, to rebuild their cult, establish it again in the world, continue the process of making offerings, I'm talking about sacrifice later, by the way, and create rites that introduce people to that deity. They're real, they're powerful, but we need to recreate their way. The Via Deorum is what the Romans called it, the way of the gods. They didn't even have a word for religion. They had to make it up when Christianity came along. Right. They just called it the way of the gods. And they recognized that all people all over the place had the ways of their gods.
And in proper pagan manner, as we would call it today, they could go to any place, or people of those cultures all over the Mediterranean, they would go to some other place, and there was a temple, and they would go in and render due honors. There was no question of belief. Belief is irrelevant in the ancient world. This is a Christian concept that makes believing or asserting a list of about a dozen impossible things every morning the centerpiece of their religion. That's nice. Thank you very much. Not interested. What I am interested in is meeting your God, whoever that may be, because then I will grow. I will be richer. I will be deeper by meeting this being that you have come to know and love, respect, and fear, but who you serve. It is in doing that and the many, many failures that will occur, the many efforts that will produce the loam on the forest floor of the great trees, the great cults that will emerge. It doesn't matter if we fail, but it damn near requires us to try. And in rebuilding those cults, we feed each other, we enlighten each other, we establish our way, and an open architected way. You geeks know what I mean. Open architecture. Yes, and if you don't know what that means, go find a local geek and they will explain it to you. And it really matters. It's when we operate within closed architectures that we alienate ourselves from each other and we don't feed each other and don't strengthen each other. But if we take an open architecture approach where we can then move between these many different cults, and I can come to your temple and your table and render due honors to your God, that I might come to know that being and where they are in the great scheme of things. Because I don't know. I only know the ones that I know. I'll help you there if you want to know Hermes or Hecate or a couple of the other friends that I have. And I'd ask you to show me yours. And thereby, we are building something new and positive and enduring, so that those who want to turn away from other less helpful ways of being in the world have something actually to go to. Because in the last couple of hundred years, there have been many people who would have been pagan, but frankly, the only thing that was around was the church. And I've read many of their lives where they said, well, you know, I don't believe this stuff anymore, but where else was there to go? And we need to build those positive places to go. And my understanding is that really means rebuilding the cult of the gods.
So we've been doing something subversive since pretty much day one in the assembly. And that is that we intentionally create sacred space in a different way. And it's a lead into something else. When we close a circle, and whether or not you use that, just follow the idea. We don't unwind the energy. We don't suck it back up. We go in the same direction that we created sacred space to dismiss it, because rather than dismissing it, we're reinvesting it in the earth. Because one of the subtexts, one of the overarching themes, both are true, is that one of our goals is the re-enchantment of the world. Every last bit of it. Because one of the things that is true, regardless of where you believe its roots are, we have gone through century upon century of magic and enchantment and the numinous being hidden. And the tools to work with it being hidden as well. So, in addition to the idea of let's rebuild all the different forms of worship or create new ones or reconstruct them or tinker with them until they work the way that they need to for the now, is also to do the other bit, which is those things which are not just the gods, the goddesses, the great ones, but all those lesser in size but not in importance beings that occupy every place. Whether you understand what I'm saying is that, and part of that is your task, because one of the changes that we believe in, I believe in, I can say we in the sense of our tradition, is that one of the changes that occurs with these great sea changes from one age to another is the way magic behaves. the way that the world responds to our ritual actions, our intentions, and our thoughts. During those time periods, it's like, are thresholds important? Are liminal spaces important? Probably if you're in this room, you believe that. We are entering into a threshold. We're entering into a liminal space, and we can ask for the world and all its parts to wake up. The little spirits, the great spirits, the gods, the goddesses, the full ecology that is the greater earth, if you will. So part of the work of the turning of the age is we have an opportunity where, in the same way that we no longer sense the push of the age upon us once we're fully in it, in the same way that after a few minutes in a room, a fragrance begins to fade, you lose awareness of it, it's going to go back and forth and back and forth. So for a time, we will be able to know the color of magic, catch its scent on the air, feel what the veils, what the boundaries, and those boundaries are like cell walls, they actually are necessary and helpful, what they are like so that we can perhaps engage the world in a different way, and not necessarily a human way. It's not just the humans, all the spirits we work with. One thing on the magical groups, it is our job, though, to support the ones that we think might have a chance, even if it is not our cup of tea. That, I think, is, if I'm going to should on you, the should I'm going to say is, if you see something that has the potential to be healthy and growthful and enlivens other people or other beings, then you might want to consider helping them out, even if you have absolutely no calling to it.
We're coming down to the last 15 minutes, and what I think I would like to do, and I will ring the bell on you this time.
Bring it on.
Is I would like for you to take a moment, and you all have given fantastic advice, ideas, concepts to the people here, the people that will listen to this later. When we're thinking about going through this transition, both for ourselves and for the larger communities, what I would like now is for you to say, what is, in your mind, the single most important thing that the individuals in this room will be able to do, should be able to do, will have the biggest, the largest, the broadest effect as we go through this transition when they step out of that door? Now, you all may want to take a deep breath. But knowing this group well enough, I'm sure that is right there at the front of your head and has been during this entire talk. Just waiting for Michael to say, let me say whatever I want. What should each individual in this room do when they step out that door to have the biggest impact on the magical change that this age will create? You have 2 minutes.
Make a commitment. Stop fucking around.
See, and I was going to quote one of my favorite role models. In the words of Samuel L. Jackson, wake the fuck up.
Invoke often. Don't stop. Keep it up. Keep invoking. Invoke different. But keep invoking. Know that is offering. Pour out offerings. Be generous.
keep a compassionate heart. If it's not making you more compassionate, stop. Do something else. But fundamentally, invoke often.
Form relationships with the gods, the goddesses, the spirits, the ancestors, and each other. The gravest thing and the most joyous thing, relationships. The more you have in your life that you identify as relationships, the more you're connected to the world, the more likely you are to make good choices.
Okay, I'm going to talk about Malkuth. I love the inspiration, and I love the fact that, you know, we are talking about empowerment and hope and truth and honor and integrity and in community. But also, my experiences is when I go out that door and I get home, I'm going to have a bill. And I need to pay it. Because if I don't pay it, you know, there's going to be reverberations. And 3 months from now, the hope, the inspiration, the community, the doing the work, it's going to just sound like a good story. Or maybe it's going to be my delusion that I'm living in rather than paying my bill. I think part of our work is to do the work in all aspects of our life, to bring the hope into paying that bill, you know, to bring the integrity and how I move, the truth into, you know, I'll tell you a story. Many years ago, I won't even cover the mouth. It was a long time ago, but I wasn't back there with Jesus or the dinosaur. Yeah, you know, but I was moving into my spiritual path. It was exciting. It was expansive. I was meeting people. Things were happening. I was having big experiences. And I was deciding whether I was going to go back to graduate school. And I had a good friend of mine saying, you don't need to do that. You know, because at that time, people were starting to come to me for consultations, for readings. They said, you don't need to do that. You've got what you need. You know, you're not a believer. You don't have enough faith. That's just going to take your energy away. Fortunately, I didn't follow that advice. Interestingly enough, that person was so passionate about her belief in that advice that she left the relationship because she felt like I was copping out, that I wasn't a true believer, that I didn't believe in the power of the gods. Because if I connected with the gods, they would feed me as I fed them with my devotion. I went to school. I got my degree, was working full time. I continued my spiritual practices in addition to that decision has ultimately read now. I have a counseling practice. I have Light Haven. I can do both. I can pay my bills. And the work I do with and through Light Haven and in my own personal practice is that much more informed, that much more real, and that much more is connected to Kabbalistically Kether and Malkuth and everything in between. So as we leave here, we go here inspired, we anchor our talents, we accept the challenge of putting the energy where our mouth is rather than just dispersing it everywhere. Let us also go with the knowingness that we can't ignore changing the baby's diapers. Thank goodness I don't have one. Walk in the dog. Pay in the bill. Because, you know, it falls out from underneath you. It disintegrates. That's mine.
We have a few minutes. So we have time for maybe one or two questions from the audience. Now, based on my previous experiences, questions.
Not statements.
That's right. So, yeah, not exposition. So if anybody does have a question, Raise your hand.
What was the arc of this group, this conference organism, for just this time we're all together? Okay. Not as an individual, but as this group that we form right now.
So the question is, what is the arc of this conference? Of this organism that we've created for this moment?
I'll be really quick. There have been five Between the Worlds. Each ritual has really been building on the previous. Each is one arc, actually. And really, this whole series was about preparing for the change of the age. There has been efforts at creating purity of intention and clarification. There's been work at planting the seeds of what we want to individually or in different communities accomplish. There has been an effort to come together and intentionally bring together different schools, different lines, different traditions, so there would be a interaction between them, so that when we approach the change of the ages, there are actually face-to-face contacts. A lot of conferences don't necessarily carefully select, these are the people we want teaching, and we make it possible for them to interact with each other. So there's been social engineering, if you will, because if there isn't face-to-face contact, there is no possibility of building trust. So there's been trust building across lines. We've been building bridges intentionally between highly disparate systems and getting to know each other as people and as organizations, so that when times get crunchy, we give each other the benefit of the doubt. So that's part of it. But the final part ends with the individual, which is what the ritual is about that we'll be doing at this one and a lot of the classes as well. Because in the end, if you are connected to a particular stream or group or whatever, that's all well and good and a good thing from my perspective. But this is about getting people to, I am officially crossing a line. And by crossing that line, I am making a promise, a pledge, an oath, whatever you want to call it, to be aware of the changes and to take my part in them. So it really has been about bridge building, trust building, clarification of connection, and about preparing as many people as possible to seed the idea of now we go forth.
If I might step out of the moderator role and back into the organizer role, one of the ideas then is we create the environment in which this is possible. But ultimately, it relies upon you as individuals to actually go to other people's workshops, to spend time talking to people that you don't know in the lobby or in the restaurant or in the bar. Especially the bar. To step out of your comfort zone, to encounter a different species. And come to understand and to create that connection between the two. One of the things that was said earlier was, what they're doing may not be your cup of tea. But having friends and relationships and allies, as we go through anything, transition, stability, hard times, good times, doesn't matter. We need them. So we create this container for you, and we do the best that we can. But ultimately, you have to speak to someone else. Someone, I hope, that you've never spoken to before. And in that way, you create this organism, this community, this body, that whose strength and whose power, whose magic, whose ritual, whose ability to connect to all that is and was and will be, will step across that threshold and be a force in the upcoming age. You set the tone as a whole for what will be. It's a lot of responsibility. And it's incredibly exciting. I want to thank all of our... Oh, I'm sorry, Thorin.
Okay. Following upon that, Michael, you just said that so eloquently and beautifully. I wonder if we can all just pause and take another moment together and just breathe those words in, maybe stretch your body a little bit, and settle into your center. Open feet, hands, and crown. Feel the presence of your gods, goddesses, allies. And breathe in possibility. And breathe in the question, what is my part in this time of transition? And just be open to that question for the rest of the weekend. One more breath. Blessed be.
Blessed be.
I would like to thank all of our panelists, Evo, Thorin, Eptha, Katrina, Samuel, for sharing their wonderful wisdom and their knowledge. I want to thank everybody that in attendance for your attention and for the energy that you provide to this work and to this conference, to the ritual tonight, to the gala tomorrow, and all of the things that we will do together as a community, as an organism this weekend. So mote it be.
So mote it be.
Now go forth now. Remember the next workshop's at 11:30?
15, isn't it?
You've got
15 minutes.
You've got 15 minutes.